for the invitation to come here. I was an undergraduate here. I think absolutely nobody in here was around when I was around, so it's kind of moot. Let me see. So, let me talk about co-authors first, because I might forget them in the talk, and then, you know, that's not so good. So I have two co-authors at various points in this work. One of them is Mario McAuliffe, and I'll point out what film we worked on together, and the other one is the speaker that was here last week, Rick Shane, and many things in the talk are joint with Rick. Okay, so now, as was indicated in the introduction, I have been interested for a long time, and I really am interested in variational problems, in particular, varying volume among submanifolds, but constrained submanifolds, in particular, submanifolds that have a Lagrangian constraint. Rather than define that right now, I'm only saying that by way of introducing really where these ideas came from. Through the talk, I actually will talk about Lagrangians in a concrete way later on in the talk. So the first part won't have anything to do with that, really, but that's really where the ideas came from. So I tried to make the first part tried to make it sort of standalone and relatively elementary because I didn't know sort of who the audience would be. So I hope I succeeded. And then it might get more technical for you, and then you can just not pay any attention, which is what people do anyway in talks after it gets more technical. So I don't know how did this, did that, did I do my, I once made a, once gave a talk where the slides were unreadable, right? And looks like you can read them, can you? Of course, my handwriting is not very good, but it never was. So what can I do about that? I guess I could use PowerPoint or, anyway. So the title's Area Minimizers and Calibrator Surfaces, and I'll explain what I mean by that later on. So the outline of the talk is I'm going to first of all talk about just area minimizers, then I'll talk about Lagrangian area minimizers, and then I'll talk about the higher dimensional case, at least briefly. So the concrete results are only in two dimensions, otherwise I would have talked about higher dimensions. So first of all, I'll just talk about what I mean by area minimizers, and I'll just start by making some relatively vague comments that aren't really that useful unless you already know them, but you have to start somewhere. So the classical problem that one should think about, I guess, or whatever, is the plateau problem. The classical problem, probably everybody here knows about it. So for example, you take a closed loop in R3 or Rn, it doesn't matter, and you seek the least area disk, for example, that spans that that loop. And that's a classical problem, posed by Plateau in around 1850. And the solution which resulted in Fields Metals was by Douglas, I think I spelled it wrong, but anyway, and Rideau in the 1930s. Okay, so that's a sort of a what I would describe as a kind of physical problem in a sense, and I'm actually more interested in geometric problems or maybe some topological problems. So I want to change the context right away of what I mean of where I'm looking for minimizers. So in particular, I want to look at a Riemannian manifold, which n-dimensional Riemannian manifold, n, and I could actually talk about higher dimensions, but for this part of the talk, I only want to talk about two dimensions. So I'm going to let alpha be a two-dimensional homology class, integral homology class, so it can be represented by a surface. And I seek a surface among all surfaces that that represent alpha. I seek a surface that has least area. Okay, so that's sort of the geometric version of the plateau problem or the topological version of the plateau problem that I'm interested in. Okay. Now there are two approaches to this problem. There are two approaches because it's a two-dimensional problem. Is that okay? Question. I'm sorry? What's a homology class? Well, yeah, it's good. Yeah, that's good. That's good for now. Yeah, that's fine. It did something more, but that's adequate for this discussion. You know, it's one of those things where I don't think I want to define what a homology class is, you know, in a complete, yeah, but you have the right idea, and you can't collapse it down. It's non-trivial in the sense that you can't collapse it onto itself. So the problem has a solution in a generalized sense, because it won't collapse onto itself. It's the generalization of a non-trivial curve on a torus, right? So you could seek a minimizer there, and you're going to find one because it can't collapse. If you look, for example, for a minimizer among curves on a two-sphere, then you know you're not going to get one. So that's the idea of a homology class. It just provides an obstruction, so you're going to get something. Make sense? That's what I mean by homology class. Well. Okay, so there are, and this is going to be sort of vague, and I apologize for it, but what I want to do really initially is just set up the fact that there are area minimizers in great generality, and there's lots of approaches. There are two approaches to solving the problem. So the first approach is the so-called mapping problem. This is really due to Sachs and Uhlenbeck, and in this approach, one fixes a metric on the surface, and then looks at maps from the surface with metric into the Riemannian manifold with its metric. We demand that the map represent alpha, and we minimize energy among such maps. Okay, so I wrote down what the energy is, and then this produces a harmonic map. We then note that the harmonic map actually only depends on the conformal class of the surface metric G. And then we minimize overall conformal classes. So that's a rough outline of how you produce a minimizer using the mapping problem. The other approach, which is completely different, is the geometric measure theory approach, where you work in a generalized notion of surface, mainly integral currents. And because of foundational work of Federer and Fleming, it's possible to produce minima among integral currents. And then the problem is to prove regularity of the minimizer. In two dimensions, because of the work of Almgren and Sheldon Chang, in fact, we know the regularity of the minimizer in two dimensions. Okay, so these two approaches, both of them give us, of course, the downside of approach B is that you don't control the genus. In the upside of approach A, you do control the genus, but there, of course, there's problems in implementing A in sometimes. In any case, both of these, as I said at the bottom, the main point that I really want to make, I can't describe the details of these methods, it would be inappropriate anyway, if both approaches in two dimensions produce area minimizers. Of course, they could break apart. They can have lots of components, but they produce area minimizers. They produce surfaces which are area minimizers, and they're regular. They're emergence, except for the possibility of branch points. Branch points are like cusp points. They look like a map of, say, if Z is a complex coordinate on the surface, Z into Z to the M, Z to the K, where M is bigger than K and M is bigger than 2. So it's a branching phenomena. Okay, so that's what, this is a wonderful thing. It's really the only dimension where you can make this kind of comprehensive claim of existence and regularity for minimizers. Okay, so that's the first sort of aspect. Now, on the other hand, that's an existence theorem, and we really don't know much at all. Having described that to you, you could well ask, well, okay, so you can produce, given a homology class, you can produce a minimizer, you know what its regularity theory is, but what does it look like? What is it? So, that's a good question, and there is, of course, in general, it's hard to answer that. There is a way of answering that in at least giving a partial answer to that. Of course, part of what my discussion is to give a better answer to that. But so in contrast, if you specify the manifold to be a Kähler manifold, so that's a complex manifold that has a complex structure. So in other words, it's modeled on instead of modeling a manifold on Rn, you're modeling on Cn. So it's as a real manifold, it's necessarily even dimensional. It has a complex structure, which I'm denoting J. And if you form this, H is the Riemannian metric, if you form this object which I wrote down here, Hj with a vector, comma, a vector, that forms a two-form, and the Kähler condition is that two-form be closed, D of that 2-form be 0. What that means is that the if you like, the Levi-Civita connection of J is 0. So J is parallel for the Levi-Civita connection. What it really does geometrically is it ties together the metric and the complex structure. So you can expect then, because you've tied them together, you can expect some geometric properties of the metric to be seen by the complex structure. If you don't tie them together, you can't expect that. Okay. So in the case of the manifold of Taylor, you can produce concrete minimizers. And you do that as so I'm going to explain the argument because it's simple and, you know, so then at least do something concrete and it's not all this kind of nonsense. So here's how you do it. It's very beautiful argument, very fundamental in the subject. So the first statement is Verdinger's inequality. This, I guess, goes back to the 1930s. It's a very simple statement, very simple to prove. If you take an oriented 2m dimensional real submanifold of your Taylor manifold, and you pick a point, any point, and you let dv at that point be the volume form for the induced metric on that submanifold, then you have the following inequality. You take the Taylor form, you restrict the Taylor form to the submanifold, raise it to the nth power, so now it's a 2m form on the submanifold. You multiply it by a factor, 1 over the m factorial, it's not really very important, then that's less than or equal to, at every point, the volume form. You have a quality exactly in the case when m, when the tangent space at P of m is a complex submanifold, it's a complex subspace, pardon me, of the tangent space at n. So, I guess I'll explain the proof. The proof's very simple, and then at least it's concrete. So, the proof, how does the proof go? You take two unit vectors, which I'm denoting here as E and F. And I note that if I plug E and F into omega, then that's, of course, the same as I wrote up there as looking at the metric applied to the pairing the JE with F, with the metric. And then by the Schwarz inequality, that's, of course, less than the length of JE and the length of F. And since they're both unit vectors and J is an isometry, then that's less than or equal to 1. And, of course, you have equality if and only if JE is equal to F. Okay. So then notice that this restriction of the Kähler form is a 2-form, the restriction of it to the tangent space at P is a skew form. So therefore, by Sylvester's theorem, there's an orthonormal basis, which I've written E1, F1, EM, FM, this orthonormal basis, so that this skew form has the following form. So I write it as you'd expect by Sylvester's theorem, as I've written there at the top. It's a skew form with eigenvalues, if you like, lambda 1 to lambda m, where the lambdas are the pairing of are omega evaluated at EI and FI. And of course, as we saw by that initial computation I did, that's less than 1. So all of the lambdas that are appearing in this normal form for omega are all less than or equal to 1. So in particular, that says that I can write this skew form as I've done there. It's the sum over I of lambda I EI star, which is a dual vector to EI, dual covector to EI, wedged with FI star, dual covector to FI. And having done that, then I can raise this 2-form to the nth power, and I see that I get m factorial lambda 1 times all the way up to lambda m, E1 star wedge F1 star, all the way up to EM star wedge FM star. And that, of course, is exactly equal to m factorial, the product of the lambdas times the volume form, which is less than or equal to m factorial times the volume form. And I've proved the inequality. Very simple proof. This uses really the only constant is Sylvester's theorem. And, of course, I have equality going back to see when I got equality with the lambdas equal to 1. I have equality actually when all of the lambdas are equal to 1, which is the same thing as when JEI is equal to FI, which is exactly the same as when this plane spanned by EI and FI is a complex plane. So the corollary, which is due to Federer, is very simple, and it's very extremely amazing result, actually, is if M is a compact complex of manifold of N without boundary, there's a boundary case, but we're not interested in that, then necessarily the volume of this complex submanifold is less than or equal to the volume of any other manifold, any other submanifold which homologous, which represents the same homology class as M. This means homologous here. I have a quality if and only if M prime is also complex. So the amazing thing about this corollary, and I'll use it later, is that once you have a complex submanifold, it represents a non-trivial homology class, and any other minimizer is automatically also complex. Right? So somehow, although that's sort of a kind of a global fact, somehow the existence of a complex submanifold representing a homology class means all other possible minimizers that you produce are also complex. Okay, and the proof here is easy. It's a straightforward set of inequalities. So the first, the volume of M is, of course, because M is complex, and by the Verdiger inequality, is equal to the integral of the mth power of omega divided by M factorial over M. Since the power of omega is a closed form, that's the Kähler condition being used, that's equal to the integral of the same form over M prime. And then by Verdiger's inequality, that's less than or equal to the volume form integrated over M prime, which is the volume of M prime. So this is a basic result that that is used really throughout the talk. So what it says, again, is that complex submanifolds in a Kähler manifold, complex submanifolds are concrete instantiations of volume minimizers. So in particular, in the two-dimensional case, if our ambient manifold is Kähler, then we have lots of representatives of area minimizers, lots of examples of area minimizers. So we have an abstract existence theorem, and we also have concrete examples. So, obvious question, I think, is what's the relationship then between, I'm going to stick to two dimensions where I know there's a good existence theorem, what is the relationship between area minimizers and holomorphic curves? Holomorphic curve just means a complex submanifold of real dimension 2, complex dimension 1. That's why it's called a curve, because it's complex dimension 1. Okay, so that's the basic idea. So I said, of course, what's true is that holomorphic curves are automatically area minimizers, and the question we're asking is, well, how close are area minimizers to being holomorphic curves? And the answer is that, in general, this is just way too vague a question. For example, if you looked at a homology class on which the Kähler form paired to be zero, then the area minimizer couldn't possibly be holomorphic, because we know that the Kähler form should pair on the homology class of a complex submanifold to be the volume of that complex submanifold, so it couldn't be zero. So this is, in this generality, the answer is, well, you can't really say much. It's just too hopelessly general. So you have to be more specific, and to do that, I'm going to introduce a concrete class of manifolds, which are so-called Calabi-Yau manifolds. So Calabi-Yau manifolds, I'll say what it is in a second, just want to say that they arise now in string theory, so they're kind of an important class of manifolds. In particular, in this dimension, since I want to look at four dimensions, so in that case, the Calabi-Yau manifolds are the so-called K3 surfaces. So what are these? Well, they're complex surfaces, so they're real four-dimension, complex two dimensions. I'm denoting the complex structure by J. They're simply connected. They have a Kähler form, which I'm denoting as the Kähler. They have a Kähler form I'm denoting as omega. And the key thing that makes them special, really, is that C1, the first string class, is zero, but more importantly, the canonical bundle is trivial. So in particular, there is a parallel section of the canonical bundle. So that means that there's a parallel 2-0 form, which I'm calling capital omega. Then Yau's theorem is that on a K3 surface, there exists a Ricci flat metric with Kähler form, which I'm denoting here as omega sub g, such that Kähler form is in the same cohomology class as the as the caliform I start with. So you start with the caliform, then you can find a Ricci flat metric whose caliform is cohomologous to the one that you start with, as you asked him. So in particular, on K3 surfaces, I always have Ricci flat metrics, so-called Calabi-Yau metrics, and I will use them now. I will use them because they have this particularly great property from my point of view, which is this. That's that they're so-called hyperkähler. So this is a little technical, but hey, that's what I need. So what does that mean? That means that I look at this triple of objects, the complex structure, the Ricci flat metric, and the associated Kähler form. And then what happens is that what, if I fix that metric, there's in fact a whole two-sphere of families of complex structures, each of which is compatible with that metric, in the sense that for each complex structure, I can construct a Kähler form. So the pairing of G, the G and that complex structure on this S2 family gives me a Kähler form. Or alternately, you can think of it as follows. You can think of giving the Kähler form in G, and that determines the complex structure, J. So in fact, I've drawn a picture of a two-sphere here. And in fact, you can the points of the two-sphere are actually spanned by these geometric objects. So I've denoted the North Pole as the Kähler form that I started with. And then along the equator, at one point, and then at a perpendicular point, I have the real part of that 2-0, that parallel 2-0 form, and the imaginary part of that parallel 2-0 form. So omega sub g, the real part of capital omega, and the imaginary part of capital omega, span a two-sphere of complex structures. Okay. Now, that's great, because what that tells me is, given a fixed metric, Ricci flat metric, I have lots of Kähler structures, lots of complex structures. So that means I have a sort of generalized notion of holomorphic curve, which I'm going to use. So in particular, I'm going to call, for reasons that I'm not going to be clear right now, but I'm just to give it a name, I'm going to say that each Kähler form in this family is a calibration, and I'm going to call each surface calibrated if it's a surface, so that's a real two-dimensional submanifold of this four-dimensional manifold, of this K3 manifold. I'm going to call it calibrated if it's complex for one of these complex structures on this two-sphere. Now, there are other complex structures, but I'm only looking at complex structures on this two-sphere. So in particular, notice that means by this Verdinger-Federer argument that if a submanifold is calibrated, then it's complex for some complex structure on this two-sphere. That complex structure is compatible with G, and therefore sigma is an area minimizer with respect to G by that argument I just gave. So therefore, the calibrated submanifolds are a much richer class. They're all area minimizers, but they're a much richer class than if I just fix the complex structure. Okay, I think I'm going to skip that next comment and come back to it later. It has to do with the Lagrangian case, which I think will just be confusing if I say it now, so I think I'll skip it. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you a fact from algebraic geometry. Unfortunately, or fortunately, or whatever your point of view is, when you talk about K3 surfaces, you necessarily get involved in some algebraic geometry. So I'm going to say a little bit about it and not spend too much time on it. I'm going to need the adjunction formula, which is a formula from algebraic geometry, and it says the following. It says that if you have a complex curve, can be singular, in a complex manifold, say a Kähler manifold, genus G, it's a complex curve, so it's a surface, so it has genus G, then the self-intersection of that surface, so if you like, that's the same as self-intersection, is greater than or equal to the pairing of the first turn class with C plus 2G minus 2. And in particular, you have the quality if C is non-singular. But in the case that we're interested in, the case of these Ricci, these K3 manifolds, the C1 is 0. So this inequality gives me that C dot C is greater than or equal to minus 2. And you have a quality if and only if it's a so-called, it's a minus 2 curve, a so-called non-singular rational curve. Okay. So I'll come back and explain why I mentioned the adjunction formula in a second. But anyway, now the question is, it's a generalization of the previous question I asked. Now if I look at a Calabi-Yau K3, so that is to say a K3 surface with one of these Ricci flat metrics, I have a much broader class of area minimizers, mainly these calibrated surfaces, and I ask the question, what's the relationship between area minimizers and calibrated surfaces? That's the original title of the talk. So that's the sort of question that I took me a long time to get to it, but here I am. Okay, now the thing is there actually is a kind of amazing answer, which you can prove analytically, but you can also prove algebraically. I've decided to take an algebraic approach. I'll indicate an analytic approach later, but if I have time. But anyway, there's an algebraic approach. So you can automatically get an amazing partial answer to this question from algebraic geometry. And it says the following. It says that if you take any Calabi-Yau metric, there's a lot of them, any one of them, then and you take a integral homology class that has the following just topological property, its self-intersection is greater than or equal to minus 2. That's from the adjunction formula. Then alpha, it's not true that alpha can be represented by any fixed complex structure. It's not true that alpha is a complex for any fixed complex structure, but it is true that alpha can be represented by a calibrated surface. So for one of those complex structures in that S2, I can represent alpha by a complex structure for that by a complex surface for that complex structure. So in fact, this gives exactly the answer to that question, at least under this topological constraint that alpha dot alpha is greater or equal to minus 2, then in fact the area minimizer can be represented by a calibrated surface. The proof, by the way, is non-trivial. It uses, I'm not going to prove it, but it uses the Torelli theorem and the Riemann-Roch theorem. So it's a non-trivial result. But it's not particularly hard, just non-trivial. Yes. In fact, the question itself is really specific to K3. Yeah, well, okay, so that this result is of course, specific to K3 because, for example, it uses the Torelli theorem, which isn't available in higher dimensions. Okay, so as I said here, therefore, the first statement is that if the self-intersection is greater than or equal to minus 2, then any area minimizer... what that means then is, since there is a calibrated one, then any other area minimizer must also be calibrated because of the Federer argument. So this sets so the conclusion then is that if you have a K3 and you have this kind of class, then any area minimizer is automatically calibrated. It's automatically complex for some complex structure. It's kind of an amazing result. Then you also make the following observation, that the integral homology of N can be generated by classes that satisfy this condition that alpha dot alpha is greater than or equal to minus 2. That's a topological fact. So therefore, every class, doesn't matter, can be written as a sum of classes, each of which can be represented by a calibrated surface. So then you think to yourself, well, gee, that must be the case then, that if I represent it in a reasonable way, that then I've produced an area minimizer, and then that would give me a sort of a canonical way of producing an area minimizer in a K3 surface. So that's the idea. Of course, it's certainly true that that if beta is not greater than or equal to, if beta dot beta is less than minus 2, then by the adjunction formula, this class cannot be represented by one thing, but I could hope that this kind of decomposition happens here. So the question is then, given such a class, beta, that whose self-intersection is less than minus 2, is it true that that at least for one of the area minimizers, it breaks up into a sum of calibrated surfaces, as this statement in blue indicates is plausible? Okay. Well, I actually believe that was true for a long time, and it turns out it's not. So this is joint work with Mario McAuliffe. It says that that you can find a Calabi-Yau metric on a K3 and a class beta, such that any area minimizer of beta will not decompose into Calabi-Yau surfaces. Okay, and actually this is not so easy to prove. I'll indicate at least a little bit of the proof, sort of the idea. The idea is simple, it doesn't quite work, but it's interesting. The idea is sort of interesting. And to make it work is maybe a little bit more interesting, but I'll indicate anyway how this goes. Okay. So, first of all, I say, I note that this class beta can be written as a sum of calibrated surfaces, as I already said, but for some reason or other, which is kind of bizarre, that sum of calibrated surfaces is not an area minimizer, at least for this particular, at least for some particular metric. Okay, so how does this go? How does this proof go? At least in some kind of indication of how this proof goes. Well, so the idea of the proof. Well, what you do is you start off, by convincing yourself that the theorem is actually false and that things will break up into calibrated submanifolds, and then you calibrated surfaces, and then you correct yourself. So the idea of the proof, so this is sort of the idea of a not proof. So you start off with two spheres, actually. They're minus two curves, so they're two complex two spheres. Then they carry the class alpha 1 and alpha 2, and they intersect once, as I've drawn in this picture. And now I look at the class beta, which is alpha 1 minus alpha 2, and I note that the self-intersection of beta by this computation I did is minus 6. So it certainly fits into the kind of classes that the theorem should apply to. And then, of course, at this point of self-intersection, I can take a connect sum, and I can make a two-sphere which represents the class beta, the class alpha 1 minus alpha 2, and I've drawn a picture of that S2 right there. And now I minimize area. So I have a representative, there it is right there, and I minimize area among representatives of beta. And what do I expect happens? Well, what you expect will happen will be that this neck that I put in will collapse down to the intersection point, but with the orientation reversed on alpha 2, so I'll have alpha 1 and then minus alpha 2, and of course both alpha 1, well, was originally complex, and minus alpha 2 is complex for the opposite structure, the structure on the opposite end of the 2-sphere, so both of them are calibrated. So that's an indication of the fact that the theorem should be false. However, if you do the following, you notice that's not right, what I just said, because of the following. If you start off, I'm going to do the whole argument again. Again, I have minus two curves, alpha 1 and alpha 2, and they intersect at a point P. And then I look at the point P, and I have two tangent planes intersecting at a point. The tangent plane to alpha 1 and the tangent plane to alpha 2. And I suppose that they intersect non-orthogonally. Then it turns out that if you reverse the orientation on one of the two tangent planes, of course it doesn't matter which one, that then this configuration of two planes does not minimize area. That's a result of Frank Morgan, that such a configuration will only be minimizing if I reverse this orientation, if the planes are orthogonal. So non-orthogonality means it's not minimizing. And therefore, I can go back and redo that construction that I just did and glue these two surfaces together and reduce the area. So now this S2 has strictly less area, that's what I mean by absolute value, strictly less area than the area of alpha 1 and the area of alpha 2. And so in particular, the minimizer can certainly not decompose into alpha 1 and minus alpha 2 because it has less area. So the minimizer will certainly have less area. So that's a kind of outline of how the argument should go. There's two difficulties to this argument. One of the difficulties is kind of obvious, and that it's possible that other kinds of degenerations can occur, not just this simple one. So I've ruled out the possibility of this simple degeneration, but it's possible that I could get other kinds of bubbling, other kinds of degenerations. So that has to be dealt with. And actually, that's not so bad to deal with. But more serious is the following problem, is that you have to find a Calabi-Yau metric with all these various appropriate properties. In particular, you have to find a Calabi-Yau metric that has these two minus two curves, and that at the point P, they intersect non-orthogonally. It turns out that's quite a difficult problem, because although there are a lot of Calabi-Yau metrics, it's still only a finite dimensional space of metrics. So you don't really have the kind of transversality arguments that you'd like to use. And in particular, the only way that we were able to solve this problem is to take a limit and go to infinity. So you take a limit among all Calabi-Yau metrics in an appropriate sense, and work at the boundary of the moduli space. So I can outline that argument to somebody if they want to see it, but I think I'm just going to go on. The theorem says that although you maybe expect that if you take a minimizer that it will break up into these nice submanifolds, it doesn't always happen. On the other hand, the metrics for which we know that it doesn't happen are somehow very special. In particular, they're way out near infinity. So now I'd like to show you, and this is finally some analysis, an argument that's sort of by way of contrast. So this argument is a kind of stability or deformation. So it's a stability argument. It says, it makes a sort of statement about that things are stably better than you think they are, but on the other hand, it's proved sort of by a deformation technique. So here's the setup. What I'm going to look at is a family now of Calabi-Yau metrics. N is a K3 surface, and I look at a family of Calabi-Yau metrics, and I assume that at time zero, if you like, at t is equal to zero, that there is a special Lagrangian submanifold. Well, I haven't defined special Lagrangian. That means it's calibrated, and you can just say calibrated. I had intended to define special Lagrangian, but I'll define it in a minute. So you can just say calibrated here. The argument is basically the same. Submanifold representing alpha. Okay. And notice it's important that I'm allowing this submanifold to have cusp singularity. So it's not necessarily an immersion, but it has cusp singularities. After all, if it's calibrated, it's a minimizer, so I know that it could have those singularities, but it has no worse singularities. And then I have the following deformation theorem. It says that when t is small, I can deform sigma to surfaces for these nearby structures that represent alpha, and these sigma sub t's are area minimizers such that each component is calibrated. Okay, so what is this saying? This says that although not all area minimizers, if I look at structures way at infinity, area minimizers may not decompose into calibrated submanifolds. On the other hand, at points, if you like, in the interior where I know there's a calibrated submanifold, for nearby structures, the area minimizers will decompose into calibrated submanifolds. This theorem should be viewed as sort of in juxtaposition to the other one. Okay. Now, this theorem is, as I said, is a theorem in analysis. I'll give a kind of idea of the proof, again, kind of in outline. It's a little complicated. What you do is you, for a t bigger than zero, you minimize area among surfaces representing alpha, and we know from what I said at the beginning that we can get an area minimizer. And the area minimizer has singularities which are only branch points, so it's a classical branched minimal surface. It's also true that as t goes to zero, these minimizers converge to an area minimizer in n g naught. And therefore, by this argument of Federer, this sigma naught is actually special Lagrangian. Calibrated. I'm using the word calibrated now. Sorry. So the claim is that when t is small, in fact, this surface sigma t is totally real. That means that it has no tangent planes, which are complex planes, complex lines. And then if that's the case, then it follows from a theorem of mine from a long time ago. The theorem says that if you're in a K3 surface, you have a minimal surface which is totally real, then automatically it's calibrated. That theorem uses a maximum principle. Now, to verify the claim that it's totally real is a little bit subtle. Away from branch points, there's no problem that follows kind of directly. Near branch points, it's possible the tangent planes oscillate wildly. That oscillation has to be controlled, and you have to control it by doing a blow-up argument. If you do a blow-up argument and then, in the end, get a contradiction by using the characterization of stable branched emergence in R4. Stable branched emergence in R4 with finite total curvature by a theorem of Mario McCullough from a long time ago are complex curves. And using that argument by a contradiction argument, you can control the oscillation near branch points, conclude that these minimizers sigma t are actually totally real and hence calibrated. So the argument is somewhat involved. Uses some analysis. Okay. So I'm running out of time, so I want to now turn to what I'm really interested in, which are Lagrangian surfaces. I'm going to go back, though, and say what I mean by special Lagrangian. I intended to do this earlier, but I'll go back and say what it is, show this slide again. I can leave the whole thing on. Special Lagrangian surfaces in this context are a special class of these calibrated surfaces. In particular, here, because I'm using the word Lagrangian, what I do is I fix a complex structure, or if you like, it's the same thing to fix a Cayley structure at the North Pole. And then the equator contains a family, an S1 family of Cayley forms. And these guys calibrate the so-called special Lagrangian surfaces. So a special Lagrangian surface is Lagrangian with respect to the Cayley form at the North Pole, but is complex for the Cayley forms for one of the Cayley forms along the equator. It's a bit confusing. So it's complex for a complex structure on the equator, but for the complex structure, Cayley structure at the North Pole, it's Lagrangian. By the way, Lagrangian just means that a surface or a submanifold of a Cayley manifold is Lagrangian if, when I restrict that Cayley form to the submanifold, is identically zero. That's the Lagrangian condition. So Lagrangians are somehow extremely important submanifolds in symplectic geometry and then consequently in Cayley geometry. Okay, so that's what I mean by special Lagrangian. Okay, so it's a particular class of these calibrated things that fits in really well with Lagrangian surfaces. So here I've actually defined what a Lagrangian surface is. So I repeated what I just said. It's a surface when I restrict the Cayley form to the surface, it's identically zero. I'll say an integral homology class is Lagrangian if it can be represented by a Lagrangian cycle. And in particular, this is all you really have to know. If you pair the homology class with the Cayley form, you get zero. That's equivalent to it being a Lagrangian class. Okay. So with Rick Shane, we studied about 4 years ago, I suppose. Well, it took some time, so whatever. A few years ago, we studied the problem of minimizing area among Lagrangian surfaces representing a class. Okay, and we studied this problem using a combination of the two problems that I introduced at the beginning. You require a combination of the mapping problem and of geometric measure theory techniques. In particular, we proved the following theorem. Okay, so the theorem is this. It says if you're given a Kähler surface, so that's a complex two-dimensional surface, complex two-dimensional manifold, real four dimensions, given a Lagrangian class in it, then there exists a Lagrangian conformal Lipschitz map L from sigma into n that represents this homology class and minimizes area among all Lagrangians that represent that class. Okay, and so that's the existence theorem, that's the mapping problem. The geometric measure theory techniques come in the regularity theorem, which is the next statement. This map is actually an immersion except at finitely many points, which are of two types. One of them you expect you have to have because, after all, it can't be any better. When you constrain to Lagrangian surfaces, you can't do better than if you don't constrain. So you get a set of points where you have branch points or cusp points. But the bad news is that you also get a set of points, or you may get a set of points, with a more complicated kind of singularity. Singularity where you have a tangent cone which is not flat. Now, you can actually explicitly write down what these cones are. They're completely classified. They depend on one integer, so there's a countable number of them, but they're completely classified. You can write them down. In particular, I noted here that there's some kind of non-triviality, a non-trivial Moslov index on these cones. They're not trivial. They cannot even be close to planes. Okay, so this is the regularity theory. Now, for that variational problem. Now, it turns out that actually we were interested in doing this problem because of the following theorem, which is pretty easy to prove, really, and its corollary. This theorem says the following. It says that if you have a Kähler-Einstein surface, so Kähler-Einstein means that if you look at the, so it's a Kähler surface, has a metric. This is a reference to the metric, and you look at the Ricci 2 form of the metric. That's a multiple of the Kähler. It's a 2 form. It's a multiple of the Kähler form. It turns out this is exactly the right condition for a reason I can explain, but not right now. That if you suppose that you have a regular Lagrangian minimizer. So you have a Lagrangian minimizer of the type that I described in the previous theorem, and you suppose that it doesn't have any singularities of these non-trivial cones. You have no singularities of type 2. Then automatically, and kind of amazingly, although you only minimized among Lagrangians, you actually get a classical branch minimal immersion. Right. Now that doesn't. So that's a non-trivial result. That you prove that the mean curvature is zero. Okay. In particular, that means that in the case when n is Kolobi-Yau, that means Ricci flat. So there, lambda would be zero. That's a particular case of a Kähler-Einstein surface. Then if you suppose that this minimizer, regular Lagrangian minimizer, you have a regular Lagrangian minimizer, then it's Lagrangian, of course. It's minimal by the previous theorem, and in particular, that implies that it's special Lagrangian. So that, in particular, it implies that it's actually complex for one of these other complex structures. Okay. Now, so the moral of the story is the following: that if n is Kähler-Einstein, and you have a Lagrangian minimizer, I'm sorry, just repeating what I said in the first theorem, and you have no singularities of type 2, then it's minimal. Of course, obviously, if it's minimal, you don't have any singularities of type 2, because on a minimal surface, none of these singularities of type 2 can possibly occur. So in particular, this says, using the corollary, that if n is a Kolobi-Yau K3 surface, and you have a Lagrangian minimizer, then that Lagrangian minimizer decomposes into a sum of special Lagrangian surfaces if and only if you have no singularities of type 2. Of course, if it decomposes into a sum of special Lagrangian surfaces, then they're all minimal if you have no singularities of type 2. On the other hand, if you have no singularities of type 2, then going back and looking at that theorem, you see that it's a minimizer, so each component will be special Lagrangian. So that's the equivalent. So in the Lagrangian case, this decomposing into a Lagrangian minimizer decomposing into special Lagrangian surfaces, and these calibrated surfaces that are all Lagrangian, is equivalent to there being none of these sort of bad singularities. So that's actually the original motivation for considering the problem of whether a surface decomposes into a sum of calibrated surfaces or special Lagrangian surfaces, to understand whether these singularities of type 2 occur or not. And it turns out that, as you'd expect, there's an analogous theorem in the Lagrangian case to the theorem that I proved with Mario. This theorem goes as follows. It says, it's exactly the analogous theorem. It says you have a Calabi-Yau K3 surface, Kähler form, and a Lagrangian class. Then any Lagrangian minimizer for that class that will not decompose into a sum of special Lagrangian surfaces. And consequently, for that particular class and for that particular form, that particular metric, these cone singularities must occur on Lagrangian minimizers. Okay. Well, of course, that's bad news. That's not what we wanted to happen, but, you know, what can you do? You can't fight the truth, I guess. So, on the other hand, that's the bad news. But as in the unconstrained case, there's a stability or deformation result available here. So in the last, I'm going to run out of time, so maybe I'll skip the proof, but I'll at least state the theorem. So it says, again, the setup is almost the same as before. You have a family of K3 Calabi-Yau metrics and forms, Kähler forms. You have a class now, which I demand to be Lagrangian for all of these different forms. And I suppose that at time 0, I have a special Lagrangian. And then exactly as in the previous case, for t sufficiently small, sigma can be deformed to construct Lagrangian surfaces in these nearby structures that represent alpha in homology. And these sigma sub t's are Lagrangian area minimizers, and each component is special Lagrangian. So again, exactly as in the unconstrained case, somehow for special, sort of strange, perhaps, structures, you do not get a decomposition of a minimizer will not decompose into special Lagrangian surfaces. On the other hand, near a place where you know there's a special Lagrangian, for the nearby structures, it will decompose. A minimizer will decompose into a sum of special Lagrangians. Okay, so let's see. I'm almost out of time. Okay, this is the kind of cute proof, and then I'll stop. You know, you're getting tired. This is the kind of cute proof. It's a little bit easier than the previous one, so I'll go through the proof, and then I'll make some comments about the. The picture will be clear, and so I'll be able to make some general comments or maybe conjectures about what happens at higher dimensions, maybe closer to conjectures than anything else. So the proof of this result let's go through it. So it's the same argument as before. For t greater than 0, we minimize area among Lagrangians representing this class, and we let sigma t denote the Lagrangian area minimizer. Then we know from the theorem I stated before that it's necessarily regular except for branch points and these cone singularities, the singularities of type 2. And we also know that if no cone singularities occur, then each of these guys is actually minimal. We saw that before. And therefore, each component is special Lagrangian. So in the case when there's no cone singularities, this minimizer will break up into special Lagrangian surfaces. But notice that these singularities are all cone points. So if we rescale, we blow up at a bad point, at a singularity, and let t go to 0, then what we'll get, if for all t there are always singularities, we'll construct a sequence of cones that all of them that are highly non-trivial, all of them have non-trivial topology, if you like, then they must converge to a cone point on the special Lagrangian. But a cone point in the special Lagrangian is a plane or a multiply covered plane. So that's, of course, impossible because these cones are necessarily non-trivial. They're very far from being planes. So it's impossible, and therefore we conclude that for small t, there's none of these cone points can occur. Okay, so that's the proof of the theorem. It's actually simpler than the proof in the unconstrained case. Okay, so the moral of the story is Lagrangian minimizers near non-singular area minimizers are non-singular. Okay, so this I think reflects exactly our state of understanding. It really gives a complete picture of what Lagrangian area minimizers look like in two dimensions, at least in the Kolobiak case, but the hence in the Kaler-Weinstein case, and hence in general, one must expect that these singularities will occur. On the other hand, in proximity to a special Lagrangian submanifold, we can expect that in fact they won't occur. So that's exactly the picture that one wants to prove in higher dimensions. In higher dimensions, what one wants to do is one expects that if one minimizes among Lagrangians, so now in Kolobi-Yau manifolds of three dimension or higher, one looks at a Lagrangian class, and so a homology class, say for a three-dimensional Kolobi-Yau, that would be a homology three class, one minimizes among Lagrangians representing that class, and what one expects to be able to say really nothing good about the regularity of the minimizer in general. But in proximity, so for structures that are sufficiently close to a structure that has a special Lagrangian representing that class, one expects to be able to prove that that minimizer breaks up into special Lagrangians, and that's in fact the program that we're working on right now. Okay, so I think I'm finished. Thank you.